The Phileas Club exists because of its patrons at patreon.com/thePhileasClub. The link is in the show notes. If you enjoy the show, if you find it useful or enjoyable in some way, then please do consider donating to the Patreon, because that is how the show is financed. If you don't support, then the show doesn't exist. So thanks to all of those who do, and thank you for considering doing so if you don't already. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 141, the fourth episode in the Brexit Saga series, The Reckoning. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. A special, special episode today, because we are getting to the last or last-ish episode in the Brexit Saga. I think we should have a catchy name for it, like Brexit Saga for the Reckoning or something like that. My name is Patrick Beja. Brexit happened, and we have four wonderful UK or UK adjacent guests to talk about all of this with. First, let's welcome my fellow European Union citizen, Bart from Ireland. Hey, Bart, how's it going?
I am doing just fine.
Wonderful. We'll also talk about elections that happened in Ireland that I wasn't aware happened, and that might lead us to talk to Brexit also. In the northern part of the still United Kingdom, Bruce is with us as well from Scotland. Hey, Bruce.
Hi, Patrick. And for the record, we're still European until at least the 30th of December, 31st of December.
Wait, are you EU citizens?
Yeah, we still are. It's just, we can get into it later, but we're not actually left. Its transition period has started.
Okay, so during the transition period. Oh, so that's why smug Gareth was able to say the world hasn't ended. The world hasn't ended yet. Is the caveat yet that we needed to add. It's just coming. It's been delayed. The end of the world, Gareth, has been delayed to the 31st of December after the transition period. Hey, our amazing pro-Brexit representative Gareth is here as well. Welcome.
Hey, everybody. We are still kicking that can down that road.
But I think it's fair to say that a substantial step has been taken, and it seems, indeed, the world hasn't begun to end at the very least. I think that's fair to say.
No, we're not showing any particular signs. There's been a couple of bad storms, but I don't think we can really attribute those to Brexit.
I mean, yes, the apocalypse might be happening, but that's a different kind of end of the world. And finally, the youngest member of the panel, because he's only been here once before, from Wales, Alex is here as well.
Hi, all. Alex here, reporting in from South Wales. I think so far it seems things have kind of, nothing's really happened is kind of the gist of it so far. It feels like everything's kind of gone off with a whimper, more of a bang, but I'm sure we'll get into that later.
I think that's what we were discussing via email before we actually started recording, and it seems everyone's sentiment was kind of similar. It was like, oh, well, I guess it happened. It's now Wednesday. That's different from yesterday, but apart from that, that's about it. So let's start maybe with a little bit of the sentiment. And I'll open, because for me, on the 31st of January, when the transition period started, and Brexit technically has actually begun, or I guess we can't say it happened. For me, the chief sentiment was sadness, because it felt like a breakup, honestly. It's like they don't want to be with us anymore, you know, or it's like a friend who says, I just don't want to be friends anymore. And obviously we've been close for a long time, and we've been together for decades in the European Union, and a lot longer as fellow Europeans. And it feels like a little bit of a betrayal, but mostly it's like, why don't they like me? why doesn't she like me? Am I not good enough? And just sadness. So I think that's how I feel. I think that sentiment is echoed a little bit with Bruce. So I'll go to him and then we can move, I don't know, towards something. I don't know. But Bruce, how did you feel?
It was pretty sad, actually. I've got lots of friends in the EU, and you know, while we're not leaving, nothing actually happened. It was a poignant moment.
Sorry, we mentioned before we started the transition period. Means that you're still EU citizens from now. You can travel, the trade is still happening, right? It's like nothing technically changes immediately.
Nothing's changed. The only thing that's happened is that our representatives, our members of the European Parliament are now, well, they don't have a seat anymore or a voice in the EU Parliament for the next 11 months. So in essence, we've got even less sovereignty for the next 11 months. Than we had before. We've got no control over anything that happens in the EU, but we are still in it, in that we can use our passports to go backwards and forwards, and so there's no actual change to an everyday person's life yet.
And so your sentiment is also like you were sad. I guess Scotland was a bit sad. Angry.
There's an element of almost anger in parts of Scotland at the way the British government has been handling it and treating Scotland. The Scottish Parliament, I don't know if we spoke about it before, but they put forward a motion to stay in the EU and to block Brexit, but that obviously got ignored by Westminster. It's sad. It is sad.
Okay, and sadness.
There's nothing good. Yeah.
What about Wales? Is it also sadness, or do you care? Bart, if you want to chime in.
Yeah.
I
have a slightly different sort of feeling, which was actually one of relief. Because, what seems to have been overlooked is what was the big fear was a crash out. Right, that means no transition period, like even air traffic control and stuff breaks down, right? The crash out was the big fear. That didn't happen because Boris Johnson got a withdrawal agreement through Parliament and the European Union got it through their Parliament. And so what we're in now is an organized separation. So we're, you know, if you want to use the divorce metaphor, we're having a conscious uncoupling instead of a blowout disaster. And I don't think that's been appreciated enough, that actually took a lot of work, and that's why the world hasn't ended, is because as much as I'm sad we're doing it, thank goodness we're doing it right.
I think, can I butt in there, Bart, because I agree with you, but then there's also the fact that this is what's been negotiated since the beginning as a transition period. We now have 11 months to negotiate every single little bit, like the air traffic control, like the European Atomic Agency, like all of these things. So it's in essence, I think it's just delaying it. Unless the government can sort all those things out in 11 months.
And you think they won't sort all of it? Or there will be significant issues on December 31st when the transition period ends?
I work in local government, Patrick. I know how quickly things move, and 11 months may as well be 2 or 3 days for some things. Bart, I didn't mean to.
You're right. There's a lot of work to do, but we could have been in serious trouble very quickly. I just think it's good that we've made it to the transition period in an orderly fashion.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
Alex, before we move on to Gareth, how's the feeling in Wales? From the last episode, I got the feeling that things were a little bit more, I don't know, muted or ambivalent. But how's it going now?
The same tone kind of continues. It's a bit of a weird situation in Wales because it feels like We're the country in the UK that will be the most impacted by this, given the amount of funding we get from the European Union. And then again, everything in Wales seems to be a case of, like, almost felt like everyone kind of ignored the day. It was just like, great, it's another day. Nothing really happened. And we just all continued our lives because, end of the day, we're not going to see the impact yet. We're not going to see it for a while either. And that's why we're not seeing these big issues right now. The question is going to be where we see ourselves in maybe 5-10 years down the line, when we're not getting that funding coming through, etc., and the kind of the holes have to be filled. But for now, in Wales at least, it's very much just a case of, okay, that happened. Okay, great, let's move on.
Has Westminster addressed the issue of EU funding to Wales directly? And have they said, we'll take that over? Or is it like a big unknown?
Still a big unknown at the moment. I think there's going to be a relatively big black hole in the budget now for South Wales that needs to be plugged, but we'll see how that goes. But right now, there's no real plan to address it that I've seen so far.
I do want to ask Gareth what his plan is now that he's gotten his Brexit that he wanted, the plan for, you know, Wales and South Wales with those subsidies. But I won't, because obviously it's not his specific role to manage that. Instead, I'll very genuinely ask, are you personally, and, you know, people of your camp who thought the Brexit would be a good thing, I guess you're happy?
Yeah, I mean, happy and as I said in the pre-record, you know, trying to not be smug, because that's, you know, not becoming. But I am glad that it's happened. I'm glad that we have, you know, an agreement, that we do have a transition period, because there is lots that we've got to sort out. Slightly flippantly, I think the Welsh deficit problem can probably be solved by all of the English people who will no longer be able to take holidays abroad. So we can all go to Scotland and Wales and increase the tourism take there. But yeah, you know, it's happened. It is what I wanted. So yes, I'm pleased about that. You know, I'd echo the sadness as well. You know, you go and look through the headlines of all of the European papers, the day of or the day after Brexit, and it was very much, as you say, it was we're breaking up. This is sad. And I think my feeling was, prior to that, it was very much a, you know, what are you English doing? You're all crazy. That sort of response. So I feel it has switched a little bit from, you know, what are you doing? You're all mad, to, oh no, this is actually happening. Now we're sad. Yeah, so yes, there's definitely a little bit of sadness. You don't want to, yeah, I think, even again, using the relationship metaphor, even when you're in a relationship, even when people are in abusive relationships, and I'm not necessarily saying that Europe to the UK is an abusive relationship, but, you know, people are still sad. Breaking up's not easy to do. And even if you think it's for the better, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it doesn't have some sort of emotional impact on you.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. I don't think you're saying that you were sad as well, but maybe a little bit, yeah, emotional, like, oh, well, it's ending.
Yeah, well, no, it's sad that the UK's being part of Europe, you know, the participation in Europe has finished. That is definitely sad. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I don't still think it's the right thing for us to have
right.
done.
Of course. It's talk about something you said. Obviously, or maybe not obviously, I think we're going to get some visa waiver program for British citizens. So I think it will be easy to go on vacation in the EU. I would be surprised, you know, just like we have visa waiver programs with almost every Western country. So I think I wouldn't count on tourism too much for Wales and or Scotland, because I don't think it's going to be that much more difficult to come for vacation to France. Just staying longer.
I don't necessarily think that I do either, really. It's another one of the things that needs to be, you know, properly sorted out, and
right.
and the population need to be informed about what the new rules are.
Right.
You know, a friend of mine's just applied for a new passport. She sent me a message last night, and I responded with, "Which sort are you going to get?" Because presumably, if she's applying for a passport now, it's going to be a UK passport. But I have no idea. She has no idea.
Well, it's always a UK passport, but I mean, I guess it doesn't have to comply with EU regulations at some point. I guess during the transition, I don't know. We don't know. No one knows.
No.
Bart,
well, there's a bigger question here as well. What color is the passport going to be? Will it be one of those new blue ones? Will it be the
this is the thing, and you know, if you have, for example, you know, I have a passport currently. I have a standard, normal EU passport. Do I have to replace that before the end of the year if I want to travel abroad, or do I get to keep that one until it expires and then get a new one?
Yeah, I'm
and
sure.
The expiration could be a long time, right? And a passport is probably somewhere in the £50 to £100 range, I'd guess. So that's not nothing.
No, yeah, I'm sure they're gonna keep them. They're gonna let you keep them for a long time, and it will just be known that a UK passport, which is pre-Brexit, has this and this kind of characteristic and effect. And
I presume so.
Guess so.
Hope so.
Bart, I mean, you're obviously, as we always say, you're in Ireland, not in Northern Ireland, so you're not in the UK, but still very close.
Only land border.
What's the sentiment? What was the sentiment on the day? And then maybe you can talk about that election that you mentioned earlier.
Oh, they're very related and yet unrelated. So the sentiment on the day was like, well, about effing time. Like, to be honest, we as a nation, we are so sick of this will they, won't they, will they, won't they. Mm. The only emotion I got around the coffee table was, well, thank goodness that's done. And thank goodness the customs border is down the Irish Sea and not across our land border. And the unionists didn't get what they wanted. Honestly, I mean, I don't share that kind of sentiment, but I heard an awful lot of people sniggering that Arlene Foster didn't get her way. We have had a situation.
Wait a second. I would like you to explain to me again what that sea border thing, how it works, because one of the big issues in putting together the Brexit rules was that the UK needed to have a border with the EU, but it also has to have no border with Ireland, between Northern Ireland and Ireland. And those two rules are incompatible because Ireland is part of the EU, of course. And yes. The solution was that weird sea border thing, which you explained to me 15 times and I still don't get it.
Okay, so the idea is that in terms of trade, so in terms of customs, in terms of regulation of products, Northern Ireland will stay under the European regulations and therefore be able to trade freely with the European Union. But the rest of the UK will go its own way. There's also a provision that there can be a referendum held to change that so that Northern Ireland isn't trapped under EU rules. And so in effect, when it comes to the difference in where does EU law apply or where does EU regulation of, like, you know, how much bloody black can be in chicken, that border will be down the Irish Sea. So Northern Ireland will be doing things the European way. And for the transition period, so will the rest of the UK. But after the transition period, the UK is free to choose. Now, as part of the trade deal, it may well turn out that the UK choose to stay closely aligned with European regulations, like a country like Switzerland does, because that way they can have easy free trade. So this may be really, really hypothetical. But what we know for sure is that Northern Ireland is staying in the European regulatory sphere, and therefore trade between the North and the Republic can continue. So in effect, in terms of trade, there's now a customs border between, or there will be on the 31st of January or December, between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, which is something that the unionists were staunchly, staunchly opposed to. But because they got trounced in the same election that brought Boris to power, they didn't get to have a say.
So what about people, though? Because one of the issues is immigration, I suppose.
Okay, and, so that's an easier one. Believe it or not, that's easier. Because before the EU existed, Ireland had a free travel agreement with the UK already. And we never joined Schengen. Neither Ireland nor the UK joined Schengen because we already had our own open border. So that just stays. We had it before the EU and we have it after the EU.
Wait, so you mean that in order to travel to Ireland, you're not part of Schengen? So it's like a visa waiver and not a free...
Ireland is not part of... We don't need visas because we're still in the EU, but we do... We are not in Schengen. So we do not have passportless borders. You have to show your passport to come into Ireland.
Right. So essentially it's a visa waiver because you
Schengen is... You don't have to sign anything, though. So visa waiver when I fly to the US means I have to fill in a green form.
Oh, but that's because they have those crazy rules. If you travel to a country with a visa waiver, you just show your passport and you're good. You don't have to fill. I guess you can fill. Some countries will ask you to fill, like, I have never been a terrorist. I have never been arrested in this country. But that's different from...
Yeah, so you land in Dublin and absolutely everyone goes through passport control. And then when you come to customs, you then have a choice of blue channel if you've come from a European place, no customs check, green channel or red channel.
Okay, so that means that, it's the sea border. Now I understand it. And then the UK will decide what they do with this towards the end of the year. And
yeah.
We'll get to your election in a second, but a little bit of the irony here, which I'm sure Gareth understands, but if you want to have as free as possible trade with the EU, you're going to have to follow EU rules for safety regulations, et cetera, except you won't have a say in it at all anymore. That's the way the power dynamic is going to work. But I mean, that's the theory that people in the EU see. Maybe it will work differently, but that's the
UK are going to have to choose, right? Because if they want to have a really open relationship with the US, they're going to have to go by US regulations, which are not the same as EU regulations. Or they may have to negotiate sector by sector and say that when it comes to agriculture, we'll align with Europe, which would make a lot of sense. But when it comes to cars or something, we might align with America. And you could go sector by sector and say that for this sector we take European rules and for this other sector we take American rules. So that it's just, if it was longer than 11 months we'd be able to do a lot better a deal. But there's a lot of possibilities, and so it's likely to not be a straightforward we'll do everything that Europe wants.
Right.
I think it's
so
likely to be much more cherry-picked.
There's the freedom to do that now that you're not in the EU anymore. You can decide, well, for this, we have a bigger trade relationship with the US, so we'll make things easier there by aligning our regulations with them.
Yeah, so there's two things at play here as well, aren't there? So there's the UK companies who wish to export. So for them, nothing really changes. So we can change what we want to do here. And as long as whatever we change the rules to doesn't make your product illegal in this country, you can still export it. So if you are exporting to the US currently, you are aligned with the US rules for whatever you export to the US. If you're sending stuff into Europe, it should already have been aligned with that because we were in
Europe. How else are you selling it? Yeah.
So there's that side of things, which as far as I can see, I mean, maybe, you know, if we said, electronic components have to be 3% safer in the UK than they used to be, then you would have a difference between what you're selling to the UK market to what you're selling to Europe now, for example. But that's sort of one side of the coin. And then, of course, the other side is what we're buying in, so what we're importing. And again, at the moment, anyone that's selling stuff to the UK from America is selling it to the European spec, and anything that's coming in from Europe is coming with the European spec. So it would only
but that's
be
the thing.
Changes.
If the US wants to sell stuff in the EU, they have to adapt them to EU standards. And if you change the UK standards to make them different from the EU standards, do you think the companies that are American who want to sell to the EU are going to do yet another alteration to sell it to the UK as well? I'm sure some of them will. You know, it's still a big market. But by and large, I suppose that most companies, American or otherwise, would find it easier to do trade with the huge population of the EU and align with those regulations. So it seems to the logical path there is, well, the UK might be better off aligning its regulations with EU regulations so that they can
attract... There's a perverse incentive, Patrick.
There's what, sorry?
There's a perverse incentive here. There's an asymmetry has just come in, right? Because you're absolutely right. If the UK were to try to make stricter rules than the EU, it will be really, really difficult. So they couldn't make more safe. But if the EU, if the UK were to decide anything goes, let's just get anything in, they could slacken the rules to be much more like exporting to places with very few rules. And then you could import a whole bunch of stuff that you can't import now.
Mm. Okay, right.
And so obviously, there's safety concerns about, you know, that sort of stuff, isn't there? But that, yeah, that's kind of the point, is that we can sort of choose to align either which way that we want to. Mm. Now we don't have to follow what Europe say.
I think the poster boy for this is chlorinated chicken, is what people.
I was just going to say. I didn't want to jump into the cliche, but that is the obvious example. You could reduce food safety standards and allow a whole bunch of cheap meat in from places that we currently don't allow in, because EU rules are really very good on food safety.
Mm. Yeah. Are there lots of Americans dying from eating chicken, though?
Oh, well, I don't think you want to go to...
The American health is not something to hold up in very high
standards. Exactly. I think American health is not necessarily the thing you want to point to for as an example.
To go into detail on it quickly, there actually is a higher percentage of people getting stuff like salmonella and other kind of diseases from poorly clean food, etc. in America in comparison to the rest of Europe. So there is some evidence at least to suggest that the standards aren't as good and is impacting health in America.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's at least an overview of that issue.
Do we Bart, get to my election?
yes, please. Go ahead. That's what I was going to switch to.
Yeah, because there's context here, right? And Brexit really has been both really important and utterly irrelevant to the Irish election. So we have had a minority government, which is a very rare thing in Ireland, or indeed in most countries. So the government does not have the majority of parliament. And the only reason the government has been able to govern is because they had something called a confidence and supply agreement with another major party. So that means is, in terms of the budget, the other party will vote with the government so that budgets can pass and therefore the government doesn't fall. And for all other votes, the other party abstains, which reduces the number of seats in parliament, making the minority government actually have a majority of people actually voting. And that is a very unstable situation, because the party that's holding up the government with confidence and supply can change their mind at any time and trigger a general election, right? If one budget fails to go through, the parliament is considered to have collapsed, because if parliament can't allocate money, it's not parliament anymore. So to everyone's surprise, that was stable for years. And the reason it was stable was because of Brexit. No one wanted to trigger an Irish government collapse in the middle of Brexit negotiations. And the only reason we have a general election when we did is, it's not a coincidence, it's a couple of weeks after Brexit date. That is entirely what everyone expected, as soon as there was this lull. So Britain voted, you know, Boris got his vote through Parliament. It was definitely happening on the 31st of January. And then there'd be a little lull time before the really serious negotiations got going. And that is the perfect time for Ireland to change governments. And that's why we had our general election this Saturday. So given the election was made by Brexit, Brexit was irrelevant in the election. When they did exit polling on what affected people's votes, Brexit ranked at like 5%. It was not on people's mind. It was local issues. It was particularly the housing crisis here
it settled,
and healthcare.
It's settled now. So how
no,
could you...
No, that's not why. The reason why is because all of our parties agree on what they want from Brexit. Brexit is not controversial here. We know exactly what we want, as close a relationship between the UK and Ireland and Europe as is possible. All of our parties agree. So there was no point in arguing about Brexit during our general election. We're all on the same page here, every single party. So that's why it was just not an issue in the elections, because it was a given. It didn't matter that Leo Varadkar had done a really good job negotiating, because we all know that the other two party leaders would have been just as good.
Okay. And, did you...
And that surprised the hell out of all the Europeans, because everyone was expecting this to be a Brexit election, but we all agree, so it just wasn't about that.
Hmm. And so how did it go? What happened?
Oh, surprising as all heck is how it went. So for the history of Ireland, we have had two parties flip-flopping over and back in terms of government. They're basically centre-right Christian Democrats. The only difference between them is what side they were on in Ireland's civil war a century ago. They agree on almost everything, but they hate each other. And so they never go into government together. And those two have always had the bulk of power. So it was basically a bipolar system. And now, Sinn Féin, who are an all-Ireland party, Sinn Féin are in government in Northern Ireland, and the same party is now also running in Irish elections in the Republic. They are a Republican party who want a united Ireland. They won the highest share of first preference votes. They did so well, they hadn't actually run enough candidates to capitalize on how well they did. So while they got the most first preference votes, they didn't actually have enough candidates to take enough seats to get the most seats in Parliament. So they're the second biggest bloc in Parliament by, I think, a 2 or 3 seat difference. So they're very, very close to being the biggest. So instead of having two poles, we're now a tripolar state. And the two parties who are completely aligned in terms of policy hate each other. And they either need to find the courage to get over a civil war 100 years ago and form a government. This is the most obvious government, is the two centre-right parties together. Mm. Or the third party has to somehow get over the fact that everyone has been saying for as long as I have been alive, we will never do business with Sinn Féin because they're terrorists. So someone has to get over something they have held dear for a century.
Do they still feel like Sinn Féin is terrorists? They've stopped violent action like, what, three decades ago?
Okay, so the new party leader is a young, dynamic woman from Dublin. She is as far from your typical terrorist as you can possibly imagine. So she has shifted the image of the party massively. But the party still has its old guard, and they slip out in the most embarrassing of ways. So in a post-election celebration, one of their successful candidates actually shouted, "Up the Ra." The Ra being slang for the IRA. So okay. All of a sudden, all the baggage hooves into view by one idiot.
Okay.
Everybody else at that party is sat in the corner cringing, thinking, I wish he hadn't said that.
And I can only imagine the party leader who's trying to negotiate to become prime minister. She's sitting there going, oh, there isn't a worse thing on the planet any of my newly elected TDs could have said. It's such an embarrassment. So yeah, that is where we stand. So take a coin and toss it, because any Irish government is possible, and there's three people who could be Irish Prime Minister.
Okay, and what does it mean for Ireland? Because you said they all know what they want from Brexit, which is a very close relationship with blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I didn't mean to blah, blah, blah.
No, but it's obvious what we want, right? We want to keep trading with the UK.
So you are going to... I mean, you're going to get it, right? There's no,
yes.
It seems like there's very little question that this is not going to, or going to happen.
That is how it looks. But if all collapses, the WTO rules, because it can't get over the line in time, that's the danger now.
How bad are WTO rules? Because it works for many countries.
Right, but suddenly having tariffs appear between everything that crosses between the island of Ireland and the neighbouring island of England, Scotland and Wales would be huge for us, because we've had a really close trading relationship for years.
Oh, because you mean it wouldn't be free trade?
It wouldn't be free trade. There'd be tariffs and everything. WTO have a standard tariff for, you know, there's like this book that you could kill someone with, listing every possible thing you can trade and what the rate is. Hmm.
Okay. Based on commodity code, isn't it? It's a huge list of what tariffs you have to charge in and out on what particular commodity codes of product.
Okay, so I guess that's the fear. It seems to me, I'll be honest, I hate the idea of Brexit, as you know. I think it's a mistake for the UK. I think it weakens the EU. You all know all of this, but it seems to me like maybe some areas are not going to be covered, but it seems unlikely that there will be major doomsday scenario happening in that regard. I guess, Bruce, you're probably the most, I don't want to, I, I think I can say agitated anti-Brexiter in the group. Do you still think there would be a potential for a doomsday at the end of December? Or, and I'm trying to get you to channel your, you know, the Twitter mode where people always assume that everything is going to be the worst version of what it can be.
Well, I follow a lot of pro and anti-Brexit people, and I think the important thing to note is that we are in a transition period, and Brexit hasn't happened yet. And I will repeat this over and over, because that is essentially why nothing, or at least it seems like nothing, has happened. But if you look below the surface and start scratching, I don't know if anyone else has heard, but there was an incident in Guernsey where they decided unilaterally, Guernsey's a little island, it's actually closer to the French border than it is to the British border. And they decided that they were going to require French boats to have a fishing permit from the day after the third, Brexit Day. There was no warning about this. There was nothing. So they just blocked these French boats from fishing in the waters. Now, interestingly, I won't go into all the fishing details, but there's a lot there that's quite emotive within the UK, because it's quite a high political item, even though it's very small financially.
But it would seem that like that would be either legal or illegal.
I guess the legality of it is not really known, and I think the misunderstanding as to what Brexit Day, as they called it, was, was that. So these permits were required, and then what happened were the French fishermen, they couldn't go fish for a couple of days while they got their permits, basically said they can refuse the Guernsey boats from landing their fish in France. So, you know, and I haven't confirmed the story, but I know there was definitely a thread of it, but there was a story that the Guernsey boats then had to, their fish rotted on their boats because they couldn't land them. Now, I haven't confirmed if that's exactly true, but I know there was a threat of it. There was this regulation suddenly put on by Guernsey because they thought, you know, they had the right to. I'm not
okay,
sure.
Okay, but let's be fair. This seems like an anecdotal issue. I'm not saying it's not an issue, but it doesn't seem like. Right.
It's an important. Well, I guess in Scotland, Scotland's got a lot of interest in fishing rights. And even though it's a very small part of the economy, it's a very big political issue, as I've said. And it's the one area. It is actually the one area where the UK has leverage over the EU. The British fishing waters, as under international law, so that's within 200 miles of the border or the median with the next country, are actually a lot more productive than the other waters within the EU. And so, you know, for example, 40% of Danish fishing stock is actually fished within the international borders as they would be defined by international law. Now, under EU law, that's only 12 miles, and the rest is, I think it's called the European exclusion zone or European something zone. And so that's free for everyone within the EU to fish in. So under Brexit, we're going to have to push that out to what it is. And a lot of the European fishers are quite, I guess they're worried about it. Their livelihoods are at stake. Whereas the British fishers have been saying for years and years and years now that that they needed the EU regulation has been that what they've been told by the UK government is that EU regulation is what's limiting their fishing. And while there may be some truth in that, we go back to our old friend Nigel Farage, who was on the EU Fishing Commission. He was our elected official within the EU to discuss the quotas. And there were 42 meetings of the EU Commission within that time. Nigel Farage attended one. So for me, there's a lesson here, because he spent his time complaining about the EU, but he never actually did anything within the EU. He never actually did his job. And then there's the irony is that a British celebrity chef, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, I can never say his name, actually petitioned the EU a few years ago, because people doing fishing, they would go out, catch their fish, and they'd come back and they would have too much. They would, you know, it would be above their quota. So they'd just throw dead fish back into the water because they weren't allowed to trade it or to land it. He got that rule changed through petitioning and through lots of things. So the EU was tractable. It did move and it did listen to reason. And this, to me, is a central illustration of what's going on with Brexit now, is that we've had this long political issue where Farage has been going on about fishing, where he could have done something for years. It was blamed on the EU when actually they were never the problem in the first place. And yes, we do have some leverage, but in saying that, the EU has leverage over our financial institutions, which are about 100 times, I shit you not, about 100 times more influential and important to our GDP, which is important to us. So using fishing, you know, as a leverage tool against the EU, yeah, you know, it's good and it's bad. And then you've got people making assumptions about what they can and can't do within Guernsey that actually may end up biting us in the arse.
I mean, I'll be honest, Bruce, I feel like you're kind of like the anti-Trump crowd. You're still fighting the 2016 election.
Yeah,
is how I feel. And I that's a sentiment that I think is common in both of those. And we always talk about the two, you know, Brexit and the election of Trump. In parallel, I think, because there are a lot of similarities, but a lot of the people who and, you know, I'm not in the US, I'm not in the UK. Maybe if I was in those situations, I would be equally livid and still rehashing these things. But yeah, it feels to me like you're fighting that battle which has ended.
I think it's difficult to step down from 3.5 years of it. But I'll also add that there's a reality is going to set in now. And I'm not going to be... I can't sit back and say, well, you know, this is what we've been saying all the time, is we've got to be very careful now. We can't go into the wide world thinking that Britain is this great country that's got all these wonderful things, when in fact 65 million people, and the possibility of that being broken even more by Northern Ireland rejoining with Ireland, which is becoming more and more of a possibility, and Bart can tell me if I'm wrong, and Scotland heading for a second referendum by the end of the year, from what I can see, whether Boris wants it or not. I think there's a real risk that Britain starts overreaching now, and we have to be very careful in how we do that. You mentioned Donald Trump. He's already come out to say, oh, actually, we're going to put you behind the EU when it comes to trade negotiations now.
Well, I think pretty... It would be surprising that a country like the US would decide to prioritize a market of 60 million people over one of 300 million.
That's still not the rhetoric we're getting here, and right. I know you're saying I'm feel like an anti-Trump person going on, and there is an element of that, but I think there's very much an element of, you know, we have to be so careful. Yes, Brexit is done. Yes, we're leaving, and Remain has now become rejoin. We're very much campaigning.
Well, yes, yeah. I admire.
That's a decades-long project, right?
Yeah, I admire the tenacity, but yeah, I do want to hear a little bit more from Gareth, who is, after all, who represents what seems to be the majority of the British people,
the winning side.
Yes.
Yeah. Only just. I mean, I'm just sat here thinking, you know, we need Bruce. We need people to be anti the popular opinion, because you've got to have balance in the world. You know, without wishing to sound, you know, really, 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 really silly and unscientific, you know, there's the whole yin and yang. You know, there's good and bad. And if you've got 50% of the people saying one thing, you need 50% of the people to be saying the other thing. And you need some people to be really, really pro and some people to be really, really not.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it quite like that. I think you need to hear the other side of the argument. But yeah. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, my take is going back to the fishing thing. I think this sort of highlights, again, a similar problem to the passport issue. So the Channel Islands have gone, Brexit's happened, so we get to decide now. And technically speaking, again, this is another one of those, I'm never quite sure exactly what's in the UK, what's in Great Britain, what's in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. But the Channel Islands are a bailiwicky, which is some kind of separate...
I'm sorry, what was this now?
Bailiwick or bailiwicky. So they are not, I think it's not part of the UK, but they are part of Great Britain. Or maybe it's the other way around. They are allowed to make their own laws.
All right.
They are kind of independent. So they've gone, well, Brexit's happened. We're allowed to do what we like. Basically, we don't have to get permission from mainland to do things. So we're going to decide that we don't want the French fishing vessels in our waters. And I think that they probably genuinely thought that they were allowed to do that.
Mm.
Whether they are or not, I have no idea, frankly.
I think they are. I think they are actually allowed to do that.
Okay. Yeah, and the fact that they then implemented that, arguably not in the best possible way. You know, they didn't talk to people first. They didn't get the permit scheme, you know, ready so that it was quickly applied, and you know, all that sort of stuff. That's sort of a side argument, I guess. It's, you know, they should have had all of the ducks in line before changing the rules. Mm. Maybe they did. Maybe they didn't. If, you know, if they're allowed to do that, then they're allowed to do that. And that sort of symbolizes, to me, part of the point is actually it's something that they wanted to do. They made the decision and they did it. And they didn't have to wait for lots and lots of other levels of bureaucracy to ratify that.
And
Gareth. Yeah. Sorry, Gareth, can you stop making sense, please?
Possibly, yeah.
No, I mean, I understand. Now I'm going to turn into Bruce, who turned into an anti-Trump, never Trump person. Don't you understand that in order for a gigantic population of 60 million people to function, then you need to refer to a common administrative body that, yes, will take some time and will sometimes do things that you don't like, but you can't just have small groups of people. And, you know, we break it down to those, how did you call them? Bailiwickies? Bailiwickies. The subtext for me is that's the principle of the EU and Stronger Together. And yes, I that's not the point here, but the fact that you're saying, oh, they wanted to do it and that's what they wanted and so they could, so it's great. It's like, is it though? Is it, Gareth, is it?
Well, from their perspective.
Well, yes, okay.
Clearly. No, and I think, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, each household should be able to decide. You know, I'm going to decide that actually, if you step onto my lawn, that murder's acceptable.
Right.
You know,
that seems extreme.
It seems extreme. But, you know, I can say if people come into my house, take your shoes off. So
okay, that yes.
You know what I mean? I don't know where you draw the lines with these things. There is still international law.
I guess you draw the line at the UK is not part of the EU, so they can decide what they want for themselves. I guess that's the line.
We have a parliament. We have a governing organisation that is in charge of the UK, so it makes the decisions on national level decision making.
Right.
We have local councils that make decisions on local issues.
Of course.
So for Jersey, Guernsey, Orkney, Sark, and Herm, their governing bodies have said, yeah, do you know what? No, we this is a local thing. It's to do with our fishing in our waters. We are allowed to make this decision, so we've done it.
So I guess I don't want to spend too much time on this debate specifically. I did want to get your sentiment on, which I can guess already, but the doomsday of December 31st, I'm guessing you don't think it's going to be so bad.
No, I think it's going to be worse than the end of January was.
Mm.
Because I think there will be a lot of stuff that isn't in place. There will be a lot of stuff that hasn't been sorted out properly. I think that will be the fault of the people that should be doing it, obviously. But people will inherently think, oh, it's 11 months away, it's 10 months away, it's 9 months away. We don't need to worry about that yet. We'll get the paperwork in order. You know, we'll work out what the tariffs have got to be. So there will be some problems, but I think they're not going to be end of the world.
Mm.
We're still going to be getting, medical supplies in and out of the country. We're still going to be getting goods in and out. There might just be a bit of confusion over exactly who's supposed to be paying what tax where. But I don't think that will stop anything necessarily.
Right. So you don't think there's going to be like significant, as that's the fear that was put forth for a crash out, I think you called it, Bart. That's the proper term, of medical supplies running out and stuff like that. That has been staved off. Probably at least that's how you
till the end of the year. If things start to get difficult around Halloween time, you imagine there'll be, stuff like medicines and stuff will get prioritized. Like, unless we have a real failure of politics, it shouldn't be calamitous. A real failure of politics is entirely possible, of course, but there's no reason to assume disaster at the moment. Like, we plenty of time left later in the year to panic.
Yeah, and I think we need to have clarity on exactly what people need to do. You know, some of my customers export to Ireland, to the EU, and it's really not clear what they're supposed to be doing at the moment. You know, for HMRC, so the government, the UK government's kind of treasury arm, have released some kind of information, but at the moment it's still all based on lots and lots of ifs, buts, and maybes.
You're kind of arguing against your camp, Garrett, now, to be honest. It's a little bit...
I'm giving my honest opinion. I mean,
right. So you expect it will be a little bit rocky, probably some things that won't be set by the end of this year, and then it might expand to, maybe a couple of years, who knows. But you expect that no one will die because of what's happening, or like no major huge catastrophe, just some expected rockiness is, if yes. I understand correctly. Bruce, you're waiting for your turn to say something.
Jump in and just say something against my loony left side. You know, I never said there was going to be, the dead rising from the grave, human sacrifice, cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria. But what I think will happen is what Bart is saying. He seems to be the most sensible, and it's going to be tough. But it's not going to be the end of the world. I think there will be casualties in that there may be people who can't get medication on time, but it's not going to be widespread and everywhere. And, I honestly think it's going to be a tough period. I think the people who voted for Brexit are going to be...
So when you say casualties, you think there might be at least some people who die, who literally die because of the
situation? I think there will be. And that is my doomsday scenario, because one person dying for Brexit, I think, is too many. I hope that's not right. And what I think will actually happen is that it'll just be a little harder for people. Their prices will go up, and things like that, and maybe travel be a little more difficult. And if that's what the British people are willing to pay, then fine. I disagree with it wholeheartedly, but I'm hoping this government, who I have very little confidence in, managed to get it through. And so I agree. I don't think it's going to be the end of the world. And I agree with Gareth exactly what he's saying there.
We're going to bring the show to a close fairly soon, and I do want to hear from Alex, who's been very polite and silent before we finish. But I do want to mention, this might be a little bit of kicking a hornet's nest for the argument's sake. But I'm not sure that if you think Brexit is important for the well-being of the country for the next decades, maybe, you know, one person not getting their meds on time is an acceptable, you know, people die every day from the flu, from car accidents. We accept that there are casualties from things that could have been prevented if we were more strict in some way. So I'm saying it so Gareth doesn't have to say it. Maybe a handful of dead.
Thank you, because I thought it and I couldn't quite decide whether I was brave enough.
No, I think it's a fair argument to make. I'm sure many people will disagree, but Bart, yes.
So what strikes me is that the effects are likely to be sort of statistical, right? So what you'll probably find is that because British companies are going to have some, I really wouldn't want to be in the finance office of a British company, because those people are in for a very tough January next year, no matter what happens, because there's going to be whole new paperwork and they're going to have to figure out whole new processes, and they probably won't know what they have to do until very close to the deadline, because this is going to go to the wire. So they're going to have a horrible time.
And that'll be the problem, yeah.
Yeah, but your average British person isn't running a finance department in a company, so they're not going to have that kind of experience. What's going to happen is that on average, growth will be either less than it would have been if all the finance departments and all the companies weren't having a horrible month. And on average, trade will be a little bit lower than it would have been if there wasn't all this uncertainty. And on average, what you're going to have is just a drag. So it's going to be that there will be less growth than there would have been. Maybe that means if growth would have been slack, then maybe that pushes the country into recession. But if growth would have been really good, it just slows the growth down a bit. Wage growth might slow down. And so what you'll have is there will be a little bit more unemployment. So you won't be able to say that job was lost to Brexit, but you will see in the statistics there was a hit for 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, who knows? And then who knows? Because it really depends on what deal is negotiated. So you might look 10 years back and say, this is all fine because, yeah, we had a blip for 2 years, but now we're way where we would have been. Or you might look and that blip could continue.
I will say, I think it will be statistical unless someone doesn't get the meds they need and dies, and then their family is on BBC4, you know, pointing fingers at Boris Johnson or something, you know, and saying, and showing the kids whose dad isn't there anymore. And, you know, I think it still won't change anything. But
no, and that will be terrible. But that has Brexit has already become the scapegoat for anything that's wrong. Mm. You know, people all over Facebook and Twitter and walking around, you know, sitting in coffee shops and listening to people's conversations. Oh, it's because Brexit.
It's like it's the thanks Obama slash.
I agree with you.
I tripped Trump over whilst I was walking my dog because there was a loose curbstone, and it's because Brexit.
Bruce, you were saying you agree with that sentiment.
I do agree, but in contrast, people were saying we're doing that, and then saying, "Oh, the bloody EU did that." So let's move on.
I mean, yes, again, it's as I was saying, thanks Obama has become an iconic phrase. Thanks Trump, there's a version of thanks Trump as well. So, all right, we are going to bring the show to a close, but Alex, thank you for being, as we are discussing in the Skype conversation, the most patient person in the world. I will give you the talking stick for the end of the show. How do you feel about all this? What do you think about the doomsday scenario or anything you want to add?
First of all, completely in agreement with Butt. I think you're going to see like a statistical shift basically going on with this. So you've currently already got people in the UK, unfortunately, do die because they may miss their medicine or maybe the health system isn't working as efficient as it should. And what you'll see effectively is that you'll probably see a rise in that statistic increasing. But where you can directly blame that Brexit, again, you'll never really be able to link it fully to it. It's one of those cases of basically, is it correlation or causation behind it? So you're always going to struggle to actually imply whether or not it was the case. And as I said, it's always going to be the boogeyman.
Yeah, but maybe, so the irony is, the problem is going to be that those who are for it are going to say one thing and those who are against are, yeah, so that's going to muddy the issue, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing as well to add here, and maybe with the doomsday kind of scenario, at least from what I'm seeing so far in the UK, is the rhetoric from the likes of Boris Johnson and some of the leading Conservatives is that at the moment that they're saying, okay, yeah, we're going to get everything done in a year. They're now saying as well that, okay, we're going to shift further away from the EU. So it's looking to be more of a kind of differentiation between the EU than the UK than a lot of people expected, particularly around some of the kind of the business regulations that are coming out now. So maybe we are kind of shifting towards a point where we're saying, actually, maybe at the end of this year, we're not going to get anything done just because the vision they've currently got, at least they're putting out to the mainstream media, is that things are going to be different compared to the EU. And then you've got the EU saying, okay, great, but this can't be done in a year, is effectively what we're hearing from a lot of people in the EU at the moment. Mm. But everyone in the UK is saying, actually, no, we're going to do it in a year and it's going to be great. So I wonder if it's a bit like maybe we are shifting towards not the ultimate doomsday scenario, but it feels like we're kind of slowly seeing like the beginning of it, like teetering in a few cracks, more of a division between the UK and the EU. So it'll be interesting to see going forward anyway.
Yeah, I guess both are kind of both. The EU, I think, doesn't really care at this point. It's like, well, do what you want, but we're doing our thing. And the UK, the people in the UK, the politicians in the UK still have to posture a little bit more. So I think there's a little bit of that going on. But I guess we'll see.
They're definitely kind of peacocking, so to speak, making themselves appear, brandishing themselves as big, hard men, I guess, to keep that kind of ideal going.
I mean, to be fair, Boris Johnson did get it done, and it's now on its way. And that, if you remember, if you go back and listen to the first couple of episodes of the Brexit saga, wasn't a given. We weren't sure it was going to go that way, and
he absolutely
managed.
I think the one thing you said about Boris Johnson is that at least he's getting something done compared to where the UK's been over the past like 3-4 years. Although I don't lean conservative, and I didn't vote for them coming in, and usually I wouldn't agree with them, I can at least say I'm happy to see that we're just getting on with something, at the very least.
Well, we'll be able to discuss that. I don't know when the next Brexit saga is gonna be. I'll call all of you back in at some point, but I don't think the monthly thing makes a lot of sense for the next few months. So we'll see. We'll see what we do. Thank you so much to all four of you for joining me on this little adventure. And I'm very glad that we managed to talk about all of this together. Before we leave, can you please let us know where you officiate on the internet? Bart?
Officiate? Goodness me. I think the easiest link to say, pronounce, spell, etc. is simply bartb.ie, where I link everything else to. And Patrick, may I make a small parting prediction?
Please do.
I think we are in for at least 3 months of posturing where everyone is going to say that they are completely not going to compromise on the whole list of things and going to draw red lines, and it's going to be all hot air, and it's going to look like a disaster for at least 3 months. And then the real work will begin. So don't panic if it looks like it's going to hell in a handcart in the short term, because it will. Oh, I want to say what's in the chat, but I'm not going to say what's in the chat. Bruce, you may say that.
Bruce, where can people find you?
I'm Bruce Wood. Sorry, I'm Bruce Woodward 3 on Twitter, and that's where you'll find me. And I'm not going to say what I said in chat. I want Bart to say it in his wonderful accent.
Okay, I'll paraphrase the way the Irish would say it: willy waving.
I think this show, it wouldn't be the worst thing that was said on this show, but I won't say it if you want. Gareth, what about you? Can people find you on the internet somewhere?
You can. So I am at Gareth Westwood on Twitter. I've recently started just putting a couple of videos up on YouTube as well, just going through doing some kind of techie how-tos and things. That's under my company name, which is Quietly Confident Technology. So if people wanted to go and have a look at that, feel free. Constructive criticism would be appreciated.
The link to all of your Twitter accounts will be in the show notes. Alex, I think you don't have a Twitter account.
Yeah, a little bit of a social media request. I tell you what, my New Year's resolution is going to be get myself onto social media a bit more. So then next time I'm on the show, I'll be like, hey guys, I finally have a Twitter account.
Don't do it, man. No. It's not worth it. Seriously, don't. Why? Why would you put yourself through that?
Well, it's going to happen, hopefully. So fingers crossed. Also, just to mirror what Bart said quickly as well, is I feel like we're going to have like almost like Brexit Junior now. As like we have the big Brexit thing where it's like 3 years of posturing and then 1 year of, oh crap, let's get this done. And now we're going to have, 3 months or 6 months of posturing and then be like, okay, well, we best actually do the work now.
Yeah, or and 9 months and then everything will be decided in the last.
I'm worried it's going to do the 9 month thing instead of the 3 month one. I think Bart's being a bit too optimistic, but we'll see.
All right. Well, thanks to all of you for being on. I'm Patrick Beja, not Patrick, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm a little bit more active there, not Patrick. And it's a pretty cool tool. And I need 10,000 followers. So please do that. And what else? We'll be back hopefully before the end of the month for a regular episode. And then we'll have more fun. Talk to you then. Bye.